maybe I am smarter. Why am I smarter? And how much credit can I take for that? None. That in itself, it dates back to my life experiences for which I'm not responsible, and my genes for which I can take no credit. And therefore, I think there's something humbling about that. And that's true for success, and that's true for failures. And people who are struggling and haven't yet managed to get it to work don't have to own that to the extent that they might. They don't have to feel the enterprise may have been a failure. It doesn't make them a failure, and it doesn't necessarily predict what the next chapter holds for them. These things are unpredictable, chaotic. Success has a lot of luck in it, and so does failure.
That's how success happens. From Entrepreneur Magazine, my name is Robert Tuckman. I self-funded, built up, and eventually sold two businesses to major players in the sports and entertainment industry. And I am fascinated by other entrepreneurial minds and what drives high-achieving people. So on this podcast, we're going to learn what they've learned and what it takes to really succeed. Daniel Schreiber is an entrepreneur and inventor. He co-founded and is the CEO of Lemonade, a New York Stock Exchange listed company. Lemonade is a high-flying, high-tech insurance company that uses artificial intelligence to recommend policies and identify fraudulent claims. Get this, it also donates profits to charities chosen by users and only retains a flat fee from each user. The company is valued at more than $2 billion with over 300,000 customers. I recently sat down with Daniel to discuss Lemonade's creative approach to insurance. Over the course of the episode, Daniel gives fantastic advice and tells great stories that will definitely help any budding entrepreneur or business person. I can't tell you myself, as an entrepreneur, how much I learned personally from Daniel. But with any story, I wanted to start by asking him about himself and where he grew up.
That sounds like a question that should have a one-word answer, but in my case, it just doesn't. So I was born in London, and I still have the remnants of a London accent. My parents were born in London, but at a young age, I moved to California. And actually, I was a toddler around Palo Alto as my dad studied at Stanford and then worked for a short while at HP. And then we moved back to the UK for a couple of years, only to turn around and move to Israel. And my primary schooling was really done in Jerusalem, Israel. And then as I became a teenager, my grandfather back in the UK passed, and my father was called kind of back to home to run the family business. And so we packed up our bags, and my secondary schooling was all done back in the UK. And then into adulthood, I kind of finished high school, came to Israel, did some studying here, did my military service here, went back to the UK for my university, met my wife. We moved together to Israel. This is my third time moving to Israel. And since moving to Israel, we've twice moved to Silicon Valley. So I'm, I don't know, the wandering Jew or citizen of the world or whatever the right metaphor is. But as I say, a long answer to a simple question.
Yeah, I figured there was going to be really interesting, because when obviously doing my research, reading your bio, and I was very curious if you would have an English accent, an American accent, Israeli accent. It sounds like you kept the best one, to be quite honest with you. It sounds like there was a family business. I'm curious what that was, but it does sound like your family played a big influence in growing up and kind of the person you became. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Maybe we'll touch on this later, but I'm a pretty strong believer in the fact that everything that we are is thanks to either our nature or our nurture, and we get to choose neither of those. So we can't take too much credit or too much blame for whatever follows. It's always difficult, particularly when you're close to things yourself, to parse out all the different influences. But what influence it had on me, it was profound, and it made me who I am for, as I say, for the good and bad that I comprise. In terms, I had a wonderful childhood and loving parents, and I'm one of six siblings, so always a boisterous home. We were four boys followed towards the end of my time at home with two girls. So that was the makeup of the family. But I come from an entrepreneurial background. So dad was, grandfather was. And actually, in my growing up, kind of in my youth, I was pretty determined not to be. So the grass is always greener kind of thing. And I thought, no, I'm gonna be a professional in the old kind of sense of the word. And I went off and did law school and became a lawyer, and took the bar and worked in a big city firm and lasted 8 months before starting my first startup. So, you know, best intentions and all of that.
How come you wanted not to kind of be an entrepreneur?
No, I wasn't thinking in terms of what we now say is entrepreneurship. The word back then in my mind was a businessman. And I felt like the narrative that I remember having in my head at the time was, I want to make money doing something I love or value rather than make money by making money, if that makes any sense at all. So my perception of the businessman was somebody who's looking for business and the professional is somebody who has a craft. And I wanted to be the latter. As I say, the reality ended up taking me in a different path. But that was my thinking back as a teenager.
Gotcha. So what was it after 8 months within getting out there that you really just realized you wanted a different path?
So I was drawn to the law for a number of things, but I trained in the UK. And in the UK, there's a jury system, certainly for criminal trials, and there's a lot of pomp and ceremony. And there's also what's known as a split profession. So you've seen it in the movies, there are the barristers who wear the wigs and the black gowns, and then there's attorneys or solicitors, lawyers who do the other stuff. And actually, it's a highly specialized thing going into court because you have to be trained as a barrister rather than as a generalist. And all of that took my fancy, the performing arts aspect of it, the tradition, the jury, all of that. And then I came to Israel, and in Israel, there isn't a split profession. It's also a small country. There's less room for subspecialization. I was not talking in my mother tongue. And Israel has a lot of lawyers, must have one of the highest rate of lawyers per capita. So I was competing with people who came out of the top universities, had a native language and had trained in the local law. And when it comes to going into court, I had none of those advantages. So I found myself instead getting a job at a large city law firm doing corporate commercial work where my English and foreign training was an asset rather than a liability. And I liked it more than I anticipated liking it. I thought that would be a kind of pushing paper kind of thing. And it wasn't. It was a lot more interesting, a lot more engaging. And I found myself deeply engaged in M&A in the tech arena and in very short order representing Microsoft and Philips and Deutsche Telekom and big VC style investments and mergers and acquisitions, but also getting very frustrated at the fact that my role there was really a spruced up secretarial role. There were people around the table doing cool stuff, and I was there writing it up in a legally kind of standardized format. So I got itchy fingers. I wanted to be on the other side of the table rather than papering stuff that other people were doing. And this was in the mid to late 90s, so 96, 97. And the internet bubble was just getting inflated. And in those days, if you had zero experience and no qualifications, it was very easy to raise venture capital money. And and in fact, there was this narrative that anybody who had ever done anything before had to unlearn stuff. They were worse. Experience was to your detriment rather than being an asset. So crazy times. And that gave me an easy path out of law and into entrepreneurship and the high-tech world. And I've never looked back.
So what'd you do? What'd you do to start your entrepreneurial career?
So I founded a company. I was in my mid-late 20s. I founded a company, co-founded a company in the information security space, went through a couple of renames, but it ultimately was called Alchemedia. And the company had developed pretty neat technology for how to secure visual stuff. I'll explain. So just about anything that you can see on your screen, whether it's a text message or a photo or an article or a PDF document, if you can see it, you own it. You can forward it, you can print it, you can do whatever you want with it. And we felt at the time that there was room for a look but don't touch kind of technology, that not everybody who can see stuff should necessarily be able to take it with them on a USB drive back in the day or what have you. And we developed some pretty neat cryptographic solutions that really created the fact that whatever was on your screen became a mirage. And if you tried to even screen capture it, literally in the video memory, it was encrypted. So you'd do a screen capture and you'd get gibberish. You'd print and it would be gibberish, but you'd look and it would look just fine. And that was the technology that we developed and started monetizing back then. So that was my very first startup.
It sounds like a great idea. I mean, even for today, 20 some odd years later, but the business, and correct me if I'm wrong, the business didn't work out as you had thought.
You're not wrong. So we raised a bunch of money. As I say, it was shamefully easy to do that back then. And we developed pretty cool technology and got a wide slew of patents on the technology and some high-profile customers. And then two things happened. The first was the big crash of 2001. And then shortly thereafter, Microsoft came to us and said that they wanted to acquire the company. And that was very exciting. It was going to be a great exit. And we went through the whole process, term sheets, due diligence. And at the end of the due diligence, they said, as you know, Microsoft at the time was, there isn't really an analog for it today. It was prevalent and dominant in ways that were scary. And they came to us and said, you know what? We've looked at it. We're going to do it ourselves. And I went back to my board and I said, there's an announcement coming from Microsoft that they're going to compete with us. And we were selling to businesses. And I really recommended a fire sale, which is what we ended up doing. So we sold the company, but in an exit that was really not rewarding. And a year later, Microsoft folded their efforts, came to our acquirer and licensed the IP. So it was one of those funny kind of turns Anyway, that's the way it turned out.
How hard was that for you? I can only imagine as an entrepreneur, and for all the entrepreneurs listening here, that to me is really a crushing blow. How did you handle that at the time? And how'd you pick yourself off the mat?
It was, and 20 years later, I'm still not sure how to avoid that trap. It was this kind of slippery slope because we knew we didn't want to open the kimono entirely during the due diligence. But every step, they just said, look, we can't proceed with a deal that we don't know what's inside. So tell us more. And then we said, okay, you know, time out. We've told you as much as we want. Let's ink the deal. And they're like, no, we still have more questions. And at every time, it sounded like a reasonable request. Like, how can we not answer that next question? And since it's a very strong engineering culture, you know, you can imagine the discussion. There's two guys at the back of the room who say, hey, Jimmy, why are we paying this? Give me two guys in a month and I'll do it myself. And I've been on that side of the table as well. And you see the not invented here culture, which was very dominant at Microsoft. And you can imagine those discussions taking place. So A, even with all the distance of time and everything, I'm not actually sure how to entirely work to avoid that next time. It's just kind of disconcerting. In terms of picking myself up, you know, it was a big letdown. I was still young. I was in my late 20s at this point, but I didn't want to start another startup. I had felt the weight of all of that on my shoulders. It really did weigh heavily on me. And I had a lot of sleepless nights. And I felt incredibly responsible for the well-being of dozens of families who were looking to this company for their livelihood and to our investors, but at a second degree. So it had weighed very heavily on me. And I determined that while I want to do cool stuff in tech, I'm going to take a break. And I didn't found another company until Lemonade. I kind of went in-house and worked as an entrepreneur, if you like, and drove innovation. But I had a lot of good night's sleep, even when the companies that I worked in were going through rough times. It was a different type of pressure. And I think I track a lot of that back to my early days at Alchemedia.
Do you think when you went back in and started assisting companies, helping companies, you thought, it sounded like you're really happy. Do you think you were going to stay doing that for the rest of your career?
I don't know that I gave it that much thought. I try to not plan too far ahead on these things, and life's turns are hard to predict. But I was blessed. I was working with wonderful people in wonderful companies, doing exciting work and sleeping well at night. So it was good. It reached a point of saturation where I was like, okay, I'm ready now. And I'd learned a lot and matured and was ready to go at it again. But it took a bunch of years.
Was Lemonade the business that you went after again once you left that role?
Yeah, it was. So I've been in a couple of companies in the interim, but absolutely.
And how did it start? How did the idea come about? And how'd you meet? I know you have a co-founder. How'd you meet your co-founder?
Yeah. So I was coming off of a role. I was president of a company that was leading. It was called PowerMat. It was really inventing the category of wireless charging. Nowadays, it's prevalent. Every iPhone has it. Every Samsung has it. You know, it's all over the place. But at the time, it was pretty much unheard of. And it was a really exciting kind of role to be leading that effort and meeting with all the largest device makers in the world and pushing it through. But when I stepped down from that company, I needed a bit of a break. And I was actually on what's known as gardening leave. So I had a few months to clear my head while I was still getting paid and didn't know what to do. And blessed with an incredibly wise wife. And as with most of my good decisions, she made them for me. So I think I would have just defaulted into another CEO role. I was, headhunters were calling me, and I would have probably gone that route. And she said, no, take your time off, clear your mind, don't rush into anything. So I cleared my study. I took my kids skiing. I did all these things that I hadn't done for a while. And when the dust settled, I realized I don't want to take another CEO role. I'm ready to start something from scratch. If they're going to be skeletons in the closet, it's going to be me who sticks them there rather than discovering after the fact, in retrospect. And I started thinking about what is the startup that I want to build. I'd been in tech by that point for 20 years, had a decent understanding of what exponential technologies are about and how they can be impactful, and started looking at industry after industry for where I thought there was opportunity. And I did not default to insurance at all. In fact, it sounds like a structured journey. It felt more like a meandering at the time. But I spent a good long while in the medical space, convinced then, as I am now, that the revolutions hitting us with AI on diagnostics and AI on the one hand, genomics on another, synthetic biology on the third, all of these revolutions combined are going to change medicines in ways that in 20 years' time, we look back at today the way today we look back in the 1700s yeah. kind of thing. But ultimately decided that the competitive dynamics didn't make sense. There were too many other people that reached that same conclusion. And IBM was all in on this, and Microsoft was all in on this, and Apple was going heavily into this, et cetera. So was looking at another industry. And I was at a talk by Peter Diamandis from the XPRIZE. I was doing Singularity University, and he was asked some question. I don't remember what the question was. I don't really remember what his answer was, but he included the words peer-to-peer insurance in his answer. And I was primed to look for the next industry to dig into. And that kind of piqued my interest. And I looked into it and created a proto-Lemonade kind of idea in my mind. And the punchline there is that after we founded Lemonade, I'll come to Shai, my partner, in a minute. But after we founded Lemonade, I reached back out to Peter and I said, hey, Peter, we should meet for coffee. I'm doing that thing that you mentioned. And we met for coffee. And
did he even know what he had mentioned? Or was that, is he like, what are you talking about?
Exactly. So here's what I'm saying. It sounds really cool, but that's not really what I meant. What I was talking about is gene sequencing and how that can be used for health insurance. So I like to quip that Lemonade was really one big misunderstanding.
I love it. And your partner, how'd you meet your partner? And tell me about that.
So as I was noodling on this idea that peer-to-peer insurance could be cool, we've stopped calling Lemonade that a long time ago, but that was the genesis. So I went to consult with only a couple of people who I really regard very highly. One of them is a venture capitalist called Michael Eisenberg, who had invested in my first startup, and I lost him money all those years ago. And we stayed in touch, and I gave him the 1 minute, you know, almost one sentence version of what I was thinking of. And he said, oh, that passed the sniff test. That's cool. And then he lists off all these people. Oh, you should meet so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so. And Shai was on that list. And Shai had been the co-founder of Fiverr, the highly successful gig economy kind of platform. And he was looking for his next gig. And we met for a coffee and started talking each about our thoughts for a next chapter. And it's been a match made in heaven ever since. It's just been a spectacular partnership. I've written a whole blog post about him. I published it a day after our IPO. It's called Lemonade's Da Vinci or something like that. The guy's extraordinary. He's just head and shoulders above and in a class all his own compared to anybody I've ever worked with. And I've worked with some pretty cool people on three continents. So he's the most extraordinary talent.
That's such a great story and fact that you guys have that relationship.
More from our guest, but first, a word from our sponsors.
Social media content is vital to any entrepreneurial venture these days. I recently started a company called Amaze Media Labs. We create branded podcasts for companies and own several podcast networks. Each of our networks has multiple social media platforms. And until recently, it's been so tedious to create content for each of these separate platforms. That is, until I started using Issue, the easiest way to make your creative ideas come to life and share everywhere you want to be seen. It's been a complete game changer for us. Basically, Issue is the all-in-one platform to create and distribute beautiful digital content, from marketing materials to magazines to flipbooks and brochures and more. With Issue, you create your content once and distribute it everywhere without reformatting. Your content is already optimized for engagement and ready to share. It's really incredible and super easy to use. Nowadays, every business is its own media company, and having Issue on your side to create and distribute your content will be your secret weapon. So get started with Issue today for free. Or if you sign up for a premium account, you'll get 50% off when you go to issue.com/podcast and use promo code HSH. That's ISSUU.com/podcast and use promo code HSH at checkout for your free account or 50% off your premium account.
And we're back.
Can you explain pay-to-pay insurance just for some of our listeners and exactly kind of what that means?
Well, the reason we stopped using that moniker is because it means a lot of things to a lot of people. So it became more of a confusion than a helpful descriptor. The way Lemonade works is you buy insurance from Lemonade. We're an insurance company, and you do it through an app or the website. It's an incredibly playful and seamless experience. The median time to buy an insurance policy is about 90 seconds. The median time to get a cup of coffee at Starbucks is twice as long. So it gives you a sense of...
It's amazing.
Yeah, of the kind of effort involved. And at the end of that process, once you've bought, we do renters or homeowners or pet insurance, life insurance. We just announced we're going to soon do car insurance. But after that, we ask you to choose a charity of your that's near and dear to your heart from a list there. And when we had started Lemonade, we figured out, we were both of us intrigued. We were new to insurance and intrigued by why it is that people hate insurance. When you think about it with a fresh set of eyes, insurance is, it's amazing. It's a community of people pooling resources, their money to help the weakest members in the hour of need. It sounds like the International Red Cross. Like, why do people feel proud about cheating their insurance company? Why is it so prevalent? Why is fraud so prevalent there? Why is distrust so prevalent? And I reached out in those early days. I hounded a couple of Nobel laureates, one for game theory, one for behavioral economics, to try and get to the bottom of this. What is it about insurance that brings the devil out in us? And we reached the conclusion that there's a fundamental flaw in the business model, and that it's an oversimplification, but you make a claim of me, you claim $1,000. If I pay it to you, you're $1,000 richer, I'm $1,000 poorer, but we're fighting over the same coin. It's kind of a zero-sum game the way it's working today. And it's worse than a zero-sum game because it's an uneven playing field. I have your money, you don't. There's asymmetry of power. I understand the policy, you don't. There's asymmetry of information. All these things bring out the devil in us and make us distrust an insurance company. So we went back to the drawing board and decided to think about how you could structure insurance differently. And we changed it from being a two-player game to a three-player game by introducing charities into the mix. And that changes a lot of things. So you, when you're making a claim, what we say to you is we're going to take a flat fee. We're going to take 25% of the premiums. We're going to keep everything else we're going to use for paying claims. If there's money left over, it goes to a charity of your choosing. You will think twice before embellishing your claims because you're not hurting me, you're hurting your charity. And we have no incentive to deny your claim because we're not going to keep that money anyway, that money that poisons the well. So that's the peer-to-peer aspect of it, is that there's a community kitty here. We don't regard the money as ours. We regard it as the community's money. It's going to go back to the community either because we pay it back to them in claims or because we pay it to a charity of their choosing.
Got it. And how'd you come up with the name Lemonade?
I didn't. I had a really stupid name, which probably would have led to a total failure of the company, but Shai came up with it. And it was fabulous. You know, as soon as he said it, it made sense to me, but it's a play, of course, on when life gives you lemons, make lemonade. So insurance is about dealing with the crap that comes along in life. And it, you think of the lemonade stand as something that's, you know, local and communal and for the still for profit, but also for helping the local church or whatever it is that they're raising money for. So it just seemed to be relevant. And you think about the names of insurance companies in America, you've got State Farm and Allstate and Farmers and State Farm, and it didn't have the word state and it didn't have the word farm in it. So it was guaranteed to stand out.
That's a great point. And tell me, when you started this up again, how did you get over those? Were you in a different mindset at that time? And from those initial sleepless nights you had with your first startup, how were you able to take this on?
So it's been very different this time around. And I don't know why. Maybe I'm just older or something like that. But I do get asked every now and again, kind of, Daniel, what keeps you up at night? And the answer is, I sleep really well at night. Nothing's keeping me up at night. It doesn't mean we don't have challenges, don't have problems, but and there's something about, I guess, the what's happened to me in the intervening 20 years that has given me a certain calmness and groundedness that allows me to contend with those pressure points without really feeling the full weight of the pressure that they exert.
That sounds like the holy grail for an entrepreneur. Is there anything you can think of or specifically how you've grown like that or have been able to do that?
No, sorry. No.
It's great that you have that, because I will say, as an entrepreneur myself and working on my third business now, it's really interesting. I think sometimes it's very difficult. Yes, I look at myself and I've grown and understood the importance of other things in life aside from business and family and friends and relationships. So I could see how that could change. But I know a lot of entrepreneurs are just so focused, and sleepless nights is just kind of part of the narrative. But I want to ask you, so many dreams of so many people who start businesses is to one day ring the bell at the New York Stock Exchange. Lemonade went public, I think during the, was it during the pandemic?
Absolutely.
So did you get a chance to go there and ring the bell?
By the skin of our teeth. So we did. Shai and I and our spouses, we and pretty much only we in a more or less empty New York Stock Exchange. July, New York was just beginning its opening. So there were very strict codes, and some people were allowed back on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. But we did decide to go. There was absolutely no need. The entire roadshow was done on Zoom. So there was nothing physically needed and no meetings that we took in person. But there was something so special about it. And the fact that it was just us and our spouses, rather than sounding kind of vacant, and it was so intimate and powerful. So it was very, very special, a very memorable day.
What do you remember most about that day?
I was walking on air. It was really very exhilarating. It came in the craziest time. To give you a sense of this, we had considered going public in 2019, and then the tail end of 2019 didn't look good. There was a reasonably large market crash. The WeWork debacle had spoiled the waters. 2019 was kind of billed as being a bumper year for tech IPOs, but actually they outperformed the market in a way that they hadn't done since 95. Uber had tanked and Lyft hadn't done well and Peloton dropped it was not a great time. So we said, okay, we're no rushed IPO, a very young company to IPO. We'll postpone it. Let's kind of pencil in mid 2020 as a next date that we'll take a look at. And to do that, let's meet in March with the bankers. These are the conversations with the bankers. Let's meet mid March. We mark the calendar for March 24th for what's known as the org meeting, kind of the meeting where you get together to kick off the process. When we gathered on March 24th, it sounded like the biggest load of crock to be talking about an IPO. The preceding 30 days had included the 10 worst days in stock market history. The whole world was in disarray. It was, at the panic phase of the COVID pandemic, and the stock market had just fallen off a cliff. And I get on the Zoom call with all the banks and I say, look, guys, we said we'd meet, so we're meeting, but clearly there's not going to be an IPO at this. But we're going through the motions because we told you, and sooner or later something will happen, so we'll do it anyway, kind of thing. Little did I know that we were meeting on March 24th. March 23rd turned out to be the worst day at all of the whole cycle. And March 24th, that morning, was the beginning of the craziest bull market. And the next 50 days were the best 50 days in stock market history. And suddenly we found ourselves 60 days later saying, wow, this is actually a good time to IPO. And we pulled in the date, and suddenly, so we were coming off this whiplash in the most crazy time anyway, in this global pandemic, and just getting there, ringing the bell, doing the thing. The IPO was a success. We priced the IPO at $29. We opened at 50, closed somewhere in the 60s. So it kind of more than doubled on the first day. And just everybody was, as I say, walking on air. It was just a huge sense of gratification.
Yeah, it's an incredible story, what you guys have created and built in such a short time. And how is it like for you running now a public company as opposed to going back to your startup, to working with other businesses, with mergers and acquisitions? Is this something you enjoy, you think, the most?
Yeah, there's no question that my 5 years at Lemonade are the height, the pinnacle of my career. There's no question. And the joy of making something is just such a powerful motivator, and doing it with incredible people. Both, I mentioned my partner, but we've really surrounded ourselves with a very special group of people, and we're backed by just amazing VCs. So we've been so supported by such, people who are now close friends, but at the time it was, the beginning of a relationship. And at every sphere, whether I look at my partner, our team, the market reception, the customers, and the investment community, it's really been, the stars have aligned in a way that I don't think we dare to hope for. So it's definitely been a highlight, hard for me to compare it to anything else that I've done.
Yeah. What's next, do you think, for Lemonade? And where do you see it going within the business of insurance, which is something you really revolutionized in a way?
I think there's this trite comment that I know Mark Zuckerberg liked to popularize about, we're only 1% of the way there and there's 99% of the way to go, kind of thing. I'm not sure that that's true for Facebook, but I'm quite sure that it's true for Lemonade. And not because there's anything special about Lemonade, but because there's something special about insurance. So we are, in our most recent quarterly results, we reported about $250 million of top line. And we're growing at almost 100% year on year, but let's just do some rough kind of back the envelope math. So if we two or three doublings and we'll make it to $1 billion or double more, depending on how you do it, $2 billion. which is already a nice top line. And you repeat that a couple of times, ending up at $20 billion, which would be, you know, much further than 100 times where we are today. And at $20 billion, we'd be a small insurance company. That's just the enormity of this marketplace. And if we doubled another few times and we got to be a large insurance company, so companies like AXA in France or Allianz in Germany, they do well over $100 billion a year and have been doing it for over 100 years. So that's the prize here. And I remember meeting with the CEO, Thomas Birbal, the CEO of AXA, who was a partner and an investor, and we became friendly. And I congratulated him on the results. And he says to me, Daniel, we've only got 4% market share. And that's the largest P&C insurance company in the world, because this is a $5 trillion market and he's doing $100 billion. So this is one of those places where, really, from where we're standing, that the total market is as close to unlimited as can be. And we could be in hypergrowth for many, many years to come before we encounter any kind of glass ceiling. And our aspiration is to become the kind of iconic insurance company of the 21st century. That's the aspiration. There's a lot of hubris in that, but that's what we're going for. And we have not achieved that, but I think we perhaps are in pole position to achieve it. If you're a betting man, I don't know who else you would bet on who has better odds at it. That doesn't mean that we've succeeded. I just like our chances. So long as that is the case, we're going to keep doubling down, launching new products, acquiring new customers, launching new countries. We announced at the end of 2020 that we'd hit 1 million customers. We did that in 4 and a bit years. USAA, who are the most amazing company in the insurance space, it took them 47 years to hit that. So, you know, you're talking about a 10x acceleration compared to one of the most iconic brands in the space. If we can keep anything remotely like that up for another few years, then that would be a fulfillment of our vision for the company.
That's so exciting and so incredible to see the opportunity ahead of you. And you could tell how excited you sound. And I'm really happy for you. And especially I love hearing, you know, the stories, and I know our listeners do, of everything isn't easy. There's so many challenges. And as we wrap up, I want to go back to that first business that didn't work out in the way you wanted it to. And what advice would you give for young entrepreneurs today who are out there, may have gone through something similar, may be questioning right now to continue with their business?
So the truth is, I'm very leery of giving generic advice. I don't have pearls of wisdom that I can package fortune cookie style and, you know, or Hallmark, you know, advice. I really don't. I'll share a thought, which isn't quite advice, but maybe it's a perspective that somebody will find helpful. It is, at any rate, a true reflection of how I think about these things. I think there is an inordinate amount of luck in this, and the luck is broader and deeper than we usually think when we say those words. My first startup was a failure. You know, I can tell a story about the good that came out of it, but it was, by the measures that matter, it was a failure. And today, Lemonade has been a success. And people who invested, early investors made 100 times their money, early employees made good. So I feel like it's reasonable to say that it's been successful so far. And you compare me 20 years ago and me today, there are differences. Maybe I'm 10% smarter, 20%, 30%, not thousands of fold smarter. I'm just not. I can't trace the different outcomes back to me in any way that is meaningful, or to doing something different, or what somebody else that is seeking my advice should do differently. Here and there, I've picked up some scar tissue that, you know, somebody can learn from. But I go back to one of the early things that we spoke about, which is, I think the luck is in kind of two concentric circles. The first one is just that entrepreneurship is chaotic, and you've got the butterfly effect. And small things that you do early, you meet Shai, you don't meet Shai. He was busy that day and we wouldn't have met, or all these early things that could have changed the outcome so dramatically. You know, I had a stupid name for the company. He came up with Lemonade. There's all these things that some of them you can trace back and others you can't, but there's these small changes that can have totally outsized impact. So there's a certain randomness that you say, oh, well, I flapped my wings. So, okay, you didn't know that flapping your wings would yield that. But I think, as I said, that the luck goes deeper in the sense that maybe you did know that you needed to flap your wings, and maybe you timed it to perfection. What are the antecedent things that led you to flap your wings so? Maybe I am smarter. Why am I smarter? And how much credit can I take for that? None. That in itself, it dates back to my life experiences for which I'm not responsible, and my genes for which I can take no credit. And therefore, I think there's something humbling about that. And that's true for success, and that's true for failures. And people who are struggling and haven't yet managed to get it to work, don't have to own that to the extent that they might. They don't have to feel the enterprise may have been a failure. It doesn't make them a failure, and it doesn't necessarily predict what the next chapter holds for them. These things are unpredictable, chaotic. Success has a lot of luck in it, and so does failure.
I love that. It speaks to me saying you don't want to give advice, but I love the fact that even at what you've created and produced, you don't equate the success of your business with the success of yourself or just in terms of a person. And I think for a lot of entrepreneurs, we get caught up in that and thinking that if it doesn't work out, and I love the fact you talked about the luck as well and opportunities. And I've always wondered, you know, if you didn't meet Shai that day or he was busy and you found another partner, or, you know, he didn't save you from, I'm curious what your name, what was the name you had for the business? Or do you
take
even
it remember? Take it to the grave with me.
Something with State and Farm in it, I'm sure. But Daniel, I want to thank you for coming on. That was really a great conversation and really appreciate you sharing your success and your failures.
Wonderful. Thank you. Great to talk to you.
And that's our episode. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to How Success Happens wherever you get your podcasts. We come out with a new episode every Wednesday morning, and you don't want to miss it. And if you like to share, please feel free to pass along the show to an entrepreneur friend who could use a boost, and I could always use the subscribers. And do you have ideas for guests? I always love to hear about great entrepreneurs. If you know anyone, shoot me an email at hsh@entrepreneur.com. or on Twitter at Robert Tuchman, that's RobertTuchman, or even send me a message on LinkedIn. How Success Happens is a production of Entrepreneur Media. Be sure to visit entrepreneur.com for insight on building your business, or even better yet, subscribe to our magazine. No joke, I found my first job after reading about a company in Entrepreneur Magazine back in the 1990s. It's always been my absolute favorite magazine for entrepreneurs. Thanks for listening and spending some time with me today. Until next time, my name is Robert Tuchman, just a fellow entrepreneur and your host. See you soon.